Okay, thank you for staying with us. Let's continue with the regular briefing. Sorry. I'll just change a little bit the order of the speakers because I know that our colleague from WFP has a hard exit, so we'll start with Gaza first. And to talk about Gaza, we have the pleasure to host Mr. Ross Smith, who is the WFP Director of Emergencies, and Jean-Martin Boisvert, the WFP Director of Food Security and Nutrition Analysis. Both of them are connecting from Rome. And Sophia Kaltrop, that I don't need to introduce you, the Director of the UN Women Office in Geneva, who is with me on the podium. So we will hear from them about the situation in Gaza. I'd like to call your attention to two things. First of all, the Secretary General's statements that we have distributed to you from yesterday's presentation, a briefing that he did at the International Conference on the Implementation of the Two-State Solutions. We've sent you both speeches, so please look at what he said. Of course, I have a few other updates if asked, but I think what the Secretary General said yesterday, together with Tom Fletcher, the Emergency Relief Coordinator, are extremely important to look at. And our colleague of the World Food Programme have also distributed to you by email the Gaza IPC alert, which has been published this morning at 10 a.m. Rome time. So we will now hear from our colleague. I think, Jean-Martin, you go first, and then we will go to Ross and Sophia.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. A half hour ago, the Integrated Phase Classification Global Support Unit published an alert on Gaza. I'd like to explain why it's meaningful. The last time there was a report on Gaza by the IPC was in May of this year. At the time, it identified a risk of famine, a projected risk of famine in Gaza. About a half million people were classified in IPC Phase 5, which is the most acute in the classification. This alert is being published today because the situation has gotten a lot worse in the intervening months. What we've seen is a deterioration of food security and nutrition indicators. Food consumption indicators are the worst they've been since the start of the conflict in Gaza. And they've now gone beyond famine thresholds in most of Gaza. In the case of malnutrition indicators, they have exceeded famine thresholds in the case of Gaza City. This is quite significant, and it's the first time we've seen this in Gaza. Now, these are two of the three indicators the IPC uses to monitor famine. We know that food consumption, malnutrition, and mortality are the indicators that are used for famine classification. What this alert says is that we're getting closer and closer to this famine, and that, of course, immediate action is needed now to avert massive human suffering. I'm available to take questions. Before I do that, I'll pass it on to my colleague, Ross.
Ross?
Great. Thank you very much. And thanks, Jean-Martin, for that introduction. I mean, let me just say, as Jean-Martin left off, I mean, I think what we're calling for is immediate action on Gaza. We welcome these humanitarian pauses that were started on Sunday, but we are not yet getting the volumes of humanitarian assistance in that are needed, despite the assurances that we can do so. So this includes not just food assistance from a WFP perspective, but nutrition support, health, medical, water, wash, et cetera, all of the things that are needed to alleviate the really desperate levels that we are seeing both from this IPC alert, but also on our television screens every day. We need to see much faster facilitation of our work inside Gaza. Words are not enough. We've had these commitments before, and what we're lacking is follow through on the ground. It means faster clearances and approvals for trucks. It means soldiers are not present near humanitarian relief convoys or distribution points, and of course, no shooting at crowds that are queuing for food or queuing for other supplies. We need a significant surge of humanitarian supplies to alleviate the suffering right now. It cannot simply be symbolic measures that may look good or make for good press, but we need sustained effort at scale for weeks at a time. This is food, as I said, food aid, medicine, water, specialized nutrition products, and others. People that are suffering from malnutrition, acute malnutrition, need more than just food. They need the proper food basket. They need medical supplies. We are also requesting to restart bakeries and community kitchens so that we can stabilize the situation and have basic staple foods available for people. So I'll stop here and happy to answer any questions on both operations and the alert that's just come out. Thank you.
Thanks to both colleagues. Sophia, on the situation of women.
Thank you. So again, let me thank you for this opportunity to highlight the horrific situation of women and girls in Gaza. 1 million women and girls in Gaza are facing mass starvation, violence, and abuse. Malnutrition is soaring, and essential services have long since collapsed, forcing women and girls to adopt increasingly dangerous survival strategies. In Gaza, women and girls are facing the impossible choice of starving to death at their shelters or venturing out in search of food or water at extreme risk of being killed. Their children are starving to death before their eyes. This is horrific, unconscionable, and unacceptable. It is simply inhumane. And this suffering must end immediately. We need unhindered humanitarian access at scale, and we need a permanent ceasefire leading to sustainable peace. Women-led organizations inside Gaza describe how women are boiling discarded food scraps to feed their children and risking being killed when searching for food and water. They have run out of basic supplies, which are critical to preserving their health, safety, and basic dignity. Women and children have borne the brunt of this war for far too long. More than 28,000 women and girls have been killed, most of them mothers, leaving children and elderly behind with no protection or caretakers. Women are enduring pregnancies without food and high-risk deliveries without water or any medical care. As UN Women, we join the call of the rest of the UN and humanitarian organizations to put an end to this horror. We reiterate our demand for unrestricted access to humanitarian assistance for all women and girls, the release of all hostages, and an immediate ceasefire leading to sustainable peace. We also echo the hopes that this week's high-level international conference for the peaceful settlement of the question of Palestine is a turning point leading to a viable two-state solution with Israel and Palestine living side by side in peace and security. Thank you very much and happy to take any questions related to the situation for women and girls in Gaza. Thank you.
Thank you, Sophia. Thanks to Ross and Jean-Martin. I'll open the floor to questions now. Let's start with Christian Ulrich, DPA.
Thank you. My question is to WFP. You are talking in sort of technical terms about thresholds to famine, and they have been passed. Can you be as clear as possible to the ordinary listener? Is there a famine in Gaza or not? And what needs to happen for you to declare a famine? Thank you.
Ross, Jean-Martin, I can't see who wants to answer, so I don't know who wants to take this, but also if the other one wants to take it, just raise your electronic hand. Should I start with Jean-Martin?
Yeah, no, this is exactly why we're here today. What we're seeing is mounting evidence that a famine is there. All the signals are there. Now, with this alert published today, does not do is formally declare a famine. That's something that only happens after additional analysis. That's something that might happen in the future. But what we are telling you now is that the indicators we're seeing in Gaza have exceeded the famine threshold for food consumption and for malnutrition. And what we're telling you, once again, is that action needs to take place now. We shouldn't wait for a hypothetical famine declaration to do everything we possibly can to prevent the suffering.
Sorry, thank you very much. And again, Ross, if you want, just show your hand. Okay, so let me go to Robin, our correspondent of AFP.
Thank you again. I've got two questions for WFP. Firstly, if you had better access to the Gaza Strip to do the analysis that you need to do, is it possible that the situation that you're able to document might actually be worse than what you've managed to gather? And secondly, a lot of people in the general public might read this as a warning, but is it right to say that when you say a famine is unfolding, that shouldn't necessarily be read as a warning? It's more that a disaster has already happened. Thank you.
Ross or Jean-Martin? Ross.
Yeah, thanks very much. I mean, indeed, I would say that if we had better access both for operations and for assessments, you know, the things don't get much worse than famine. So I think we definitely, we'll definitely be confirming that once we're able to get more assessment data, as Jean-Martin has outlined some of the technical process there. But you know, what we need is this sustained access for an extended period of time to be able to reach people where they are.
Absolutely. Other questions in the room? You have a follow-up? Go ahead.
Yeah, and then just on the second question about whether this should be read by the general public more as a warning or more that a disaster has already happened.
Well, yeah, I'll just follow up on that. I mean, it's clearly a disaster is unfolding in front of our eyes, in front of our television screens. This is not a warning. This is a call to action. This is unlike anything we have seen in this century. It reminds us of previous disasters in Ethiopia or Biafra in the past century. And it's clear that we need urgent action now. So this is definitely not a warning. This is a call to action.
Very clear. Other question in the room, or I'll go to the platform. Okay, so let's start with with Gabriela Sotomayor from Proceso, Mexico.
Yes, thank you very much for the question. You are saying that, okay, the disaster is already there, no? The famine, girls and children. But what is the responsibility of the state of Hamas of providing food to their citizens?
Who would like to answer on this? Any hand up? Ross?
Sure. I mean, I think it's quite clear under international humanitarian law that the state of Israel does have a duty to provide both protection to civilians and support to the population of all citizens inside Israel. And so, I mean, Hamas is one of the parties to the conflict at the moment. But I think I'm not an international humanitarian law expert, but others have weighed in from the UN, and you've heard that, I think, quite clearly in other press briefings. So that's, you know, I think that is our position. And currently at the moment, the only way to provide support inside Gaza is with humanitarian assistance, where markets are not functioning at all and people are not able to provide for themselves.
Gabriela, you have a follow-up?
Yes, I understand that. But Israel, as the power in there, the occupancy, whatever.
Occupying.
So the one that is sorry for my English right now, but I understand that. But the government of Palestine is the leaders are Hamas, so they must have also a responsibility there, and I understand that humanitarians are the only one that can help right now. But do you have any relation with Hamas? What do they think about their population? Do they feel bad because they are dying, starving? That is my question. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I can respond to that. I mean, I think what we're here today to present is this IPC alert on the state of the situation inside Gaza. And we know that, as I've said before, it's not a warning. It is an active and significant humanitarian catastrophe. We need all actors to come together to support this humanitarian action, including actors on the ground, to be able to allow us to have humanitarian access to reach people where they are. I won't comment on the views of Hamas. Of course, I wouldn't know those. But our interest is actually reaching the people, the civilians, the vulnerable families in need, the women and children that are clearly, clearly suffering right now.
Absolutely. Satoko Adachi, Yumi Uri Shimbun.
Yes, thank you very much for doing this. I have a question to Mr. Ross Smith. You talk about the humanitarian aid that was started on Sunday. Does that include fuel delivery into Gaza? Thank you.
Yes.
Ross, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, indeed. I think we are calling for both, you know, food and non-food humanitarian relief supplies, as well as fuel for both operations, for the restart of bakeries, kitchens, hospitals, etc. So it does include that. And certainly, as I said, we have not gotten the authorization, the permission to move in the volumes that we've requested.
Absolutely. Just to complement this, I understand that OCHA has recently, that was yesterday, reports that modest quantities of food entered Gaza last week. And obviously, as Ross said, fuel must be allowed in consistently and at the volume needed to keep aid operation running, including operating the trucks to collect and distribute the cargo. Satako, your hand is still up. Do you have a follow-up? I see it's gone, so let's go to Imogen Fuchs, BBC.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. We heard President Trump say yesterday in Scotland that the US was going to set up food distribution centres in Gaza. Have you had any information about what that might be, and or have they been in touch with you? Or are you able to say to the US, actually, the UN is there, we're experienced, we can do it?
Yeah, I mean we're aware of these comments, and of course we're talking to all parties involved. But as you've indicated, I think our view is that we definitely have the capacity and the expertise, and of course the proven experience during the past ceasefire to reach people as needed in Gaza. So we don't need a new system. We just need to be able to be allowed to work and to be able to reach people where they are. During the last ceasefire, WP alone was bringing in more than 200 trucks per day, operating in more than 400 distribution sites. And, you know, we know that we need a broad coverage. We need to reach people where they are, because many people are trapped in different locations. There are many vulnerabilities where they can't move. We need to restart bakeries and kitchens so they can have access to these sort of regular meals, as well as other nutrition support and other support. So just, you know, I think we don't need a new system. We just need to be able to allow to work, and we need to go beyond the rhetoric and beyond the words, and to see sustained action on the ground. And that's what we've been calling for at this time.
Thank you very much. Olivia Le Poudvin, Reuters.
Hi all, thank you. Just my first question is, this alert that we've had today from the IPC, what is it actually going to change materially? I can hear you are extremely concerned, but I mean, is your hope that this is going to put immediate action on governments to actually respond to your calls? Because I'm conscious this is, you know, this crisis has been unfolding for months, and we have heard very similar and stark warnings from all agencies, both here on the call and beyond. I also have a question for the World Food Programme, but also other agencies, if they may. Could you just outline what you have actually been able to get in since Sunday? I understand yesterday that the World Food Programme got about 60 trucks in, which is short of the 100 truck target. Are we seeing the same picture today, and why are you not able to get as many trucks in as you would like? Thank you.
Ross or Jean-Martin?
Yeah, I'll let Jean-Martin take the first one. I can happy to talk about the second.
I appreciate it. Look, these alerts are vital. This is the system that's used to ascertain what the situation is like on the ground. For a very long time, the IPC alerts and the IPC analyses that we've had have expressed a very high level of concern about the food security and the nutrition situation in Gaza. This is not the first time that we've expressed our concern. The last alert was about a risk of famine in all parts of Gaza. About a year ago, there was also a statement about how bad the situation had gotten. We're here today to tell you that the indicators have reached a level that we haven't seen yet, that we haven't seen before. And this is meant to catalyze action. What we're hoping to do is keep Gaza on the agenda to ensure that there is evidence for the advocacy that is taking place in humanitarian circles, and ensure that Gazans receive the support that they require. It's important to bring evidence. And to add to what Ross was explaining earlier, the data that we have on Gaza shows that when there is access, that when the trucks do come in, that when the humanitarians are able to carry out distributions, these food security indicators improve dramatically. And what we need is a chance to be able to do the work that that we're mandated to do. Perhaps over to Ross for the second part of the question.
Yeah, thanks, Jean-Martin. Thanks, Olivia, for the question. Just to say, we're getting about approximately 50% of what we're requesting into Gaza since these humanitarian pauses started on Sunday. And I outlined earlier some of the challenges we continue to experience.
Thank you very much. Oh, yes, Robin, sorry.
Yeah, thank you. Just a couple more questions. In terms of getting stuff into the Gaza Strip since this change happened on Sunday, what has actually changed in terms of permissions and restrictions and that sort of thing? And secondly, on airdrops, some countries have been performing airdrops of aid over the Gaza Strip. Can you speak about how useful they are compared to getting the full sort of humanitarian convoys that you're used to getting in? Thank you.
On the airdrops, I don't know if you want to say something or I have an answer for that. Maybe I'll start with that, then I'll give you the floor. What we can say is that, of course, we have seen that airdrops have resumed two days ago in Gaza. While the UN welcomes all efforts to provide aid to people who desperately need it, UN agencies and partners remind that airdrops are the last resort measure and carry risk for people on the ground. Injuries were reported 2 days ago when packages fell on tents. That is what I had on the airdrops, but maybe Ross and Jean-Martin have got more.
Sure.
The first question.
Thanks. Just to emphasize what you indicated on airdrops. I mean, certainly we have extensive experience in other operational contexts on airdrops, and it really is a last resort where there are no other logistics or transport options. In addition to being, you know, far too expensive and inefficient, it just is not a practical solution in this context. It carries extreme risk for populations that are, you know, in a very dense population base in different parts of Gaza. And we've seen some of those reports of injuries already. So while I appreciate the symbolic nature of it, it is not a practical solution. And we do have that practical solution waiting, ready at the borders of Gaza, at the crossing points, and ready to move. Your first question on what has changed. I mean, I think we appreciate and we welcome these humanitarian pauses, and we would like to see the full spirit of them implemented all along, right down to the distribution point, so that we can move quickly and effectively. Until those different delays and approvals, clearances, the interaction with armed forces and civilians on the ground, until that is improved, we're not going to see sufficient enough change to turn the dial on the humanitarian situation inside Gaza.
I have two follow-ups from Gabriela and Olivia, and then we will go to the next item. Gabriela.
Hey, thank you very much, Alessandra. So just to clarify, I would like to know how many convoys are needed daily to ensure that Palestinians have food and drinking water on a sustained basis. So this is not like a handout. So a week of humanitarian aid won't resolve the situation. So to prevent children from dying from hunger, women, what do you need every day in a sustained way?
Ross?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, let me just say the one key figure that is important is, you know, in pre-conflict, we had at least 500 trucks a day moving into Gaza with commercial supplies. And this is what was required to sustain the population, the needs of the population inside Gaza. So we are asking for right now for WFP alone for 100 trucks per day. And that is a very bare minimum of food and nutrition support, but other agencies also have additional requirements on top of that. During the ceasefire earlier this year, we had more than 200 trucks a day alone of WFP supplies and up to 400 per day, including all partners. So that's really what we're looking at, the volume that we're looking at in order to be able to meet the needs of people on the ground. And so if we're at 50% of 100 trucks a day now, we're far, far away from where we need to be. Thank you.
Olivia?
Thank you so much for coming back to me, and I do really appreciate the granular detail you're able to give us. I did just want to double check, you gave that very helpful detail, Ross, that only about 50% of what you're requesting is getting into Gaza since the humanitarian pauses started on Sunday. So is that around then so far kind of about 50, averaging about 50 trucks getting in? That's kind of part one of the question. And then I just wanted to check in with you in terms of if levels do stay like this and you're only able to get about half in of what you're hoping for, what does that mean in real terms for trying to tackle now what is, famine-like conditions? Does this mean that your plans to reopen bakeries and provide hot meals for people via community kitchens, which I know you've said is vital, does that mean those plans might not be able to go ahead this week, given that you're only getting half of the amount in? Thank you.
Thanks for the follow-up, Olivia. Indeed, that's what it means. I mean, we're not going to be able to address the needs of the population or the severity of the situation unless we can move in the volume that we need of humanitarian supplies. I think it's a very simple equation. And so if we're only able to move in half of that or some we're not meeting what's required, the metric of success here is not the number of trucks. The metric of success is, are we able to alleviate the situation on the ground? Are we able to turn the dial on the state of severe acute malnutrition? Are we able to provide the food basket and to meet the needs of vulnerable households there? My colleague at the podium there talking about the needs of women and children, are we able to address the situation? That's the metric of success. It's not the number of trucks, although that is an important part of the process. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Olivia, Gorky has been patiently waiting, so if you don't mind, I give Gorky the floor first. Gorky, vous avez la parole, mais il faut enlever votre... il faut unmute. Voilà.
Allô?
Voilà, on vous entend.
Bonjour. Merci beaucoup, Alessandra, et what Farah wrote in brief, j'ai deux questions. La première, ce sera à vous, Alessandra, pour envoyer à New York. Est-ce que, à partir de ce que nous sommes en train de vivre aujourd'hui, nous avons même dépassé le stade de génocide et d'affamer des gens où un État a atteint le stade ultime de l'inhumanité? Ma question
Gorky,
est de savoir...
on vous entend oui. Vraiment, vraiment super mal. Et en plus, comme vous parlez français, et je pense que ça va être compliqué pour nos invités, est-ce que ça vous embêterait d'écrire vos questions dans les chats? Et puis moi, je vais les lire, s'il vous plaît, parce qu'on vous entend trop mal.
Can you hear me right now?
Essayez encore.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Essayez de allez-y. Maybe we can hear you better now. Try. Give it a try.
Okay. My question is there any means for the United Nations to withdraw a country which has reached the top of the top of humanity?
No, Gorky, c'est pas possible. Gorky, ça vient trop broken. Je suis désolée, mais on peut pas comprendre ce que vous dites. Envoyez-moi les questions par écrit, s'il vous plaît. Je vais les lire. Je suis désolée, mais au début c'est bon, et puis après les mots sont saccadés. Je m'excuse, mais on n'entend pas. Olivia, you had another follow-up, and then we'll go to the next speaker.
Thank you so much, and I do apologise for my third question. I just did want to clarify that the question on whether community kitchens and bakeries can still open as planned, or whether that might be delayed given the lack of aid getting in. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Olivia. We don't yet have sufficient stocks nor permission to open those bakeries and kitchens, and we are asking for that.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much. So I'd like to do you want to add anything, Sophia, before we close the subject? Your mic.
Thank you, Alessandra. Now, just to say that we are working closely with partners as the WFP to address the specific needs of women and girls, and to reiterate that they are bearing the brunt of the conflict and the food crisis. So everything we can do jointly to address and alleviate their suffering is, of course, of extreme urgency. Thank you, Alessandra.
Thank you, Sophia, and thanks to Ross and to Jean-Martin for the briefing to the Geneva Press Corps, and hopefully you can come back and update us on the situation in the next days. Thanks, and thanks, Sophia. Let me now go with UNEP to the next item on our list. I'd like to welcome Jyoti Matul-Philip, who is the Executive Secretary of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee on Plastic Pollution and head of the Secretariat. Jyoti is coming to us from Nairobi, and I'd like to welcome her and thank her for her patience, because we had, unfortunately, to change the agenda. And she's here to tell us about the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee process and structure. As you know, the committee is meeting in Geneva from the 5th of August for 2 weeks. And so Jyoti is going to give you a little bit more information on this very important meeting that we are very happy to host at the Palais. Jyoti, you have the floor.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon from Nairobi, everyone. And of course, for those joining us from other parts of the world, good morning and good evening. Today, I wish to provide you with background on the INC process, highlight a few key milestones, and then outline the structure of the second part of the fifth session, INC 5.2 for short, which will be held Tuesday, from Tuesday, 5th of August, through Thursday, 14th of August at the Palais des Nations, as Alessandra just said. We are at this moment because in 2022, at the UN Environment Assembly, Member States adopted a resolution called 514, which convened the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee to develop an international legally binding instrument on plastic pollution, including in the marine environment. The resolution's mandate calls for a comprehensive approach that addresses the life cycle of plastic, including its production, design, and disposal. Pursuant to the resolution, the INC began its work in 2022, and it has been a very busy time since then. Five negotiation sessions have already taken place. The first INC one took place in Uruguay in November 2022. Two more followed in 2023 in France and Kenya. In April 2024, we convened again in Canada. And most recently, INC 5.1, the first part of the fifth session, was held in Busan, Republic of Korea, at the end of last year. At the end of INC 5.1, the committee adjourned and agreed to resume for a second session for the second part, INC 5.2, now before us, under the leadership of the chair of the committee, Ambassador Luis Valles Valdivieso of Ecuador. Before adjourning, the committee also agreed that the chair's text, which was released on 1st of December and available on the INC website, would serve as the starting point for negotiations. In the lead up to INC 5.2, the chair of the INC has convened informal in-person and online heads of delegation meetings, which provided important opportunities for members to engage ahead of the resumed session. Also, the INC secretariat facilitated opportunities for the members to conduct informal discussions to advance consultations with a series of regional consultations held in June and July across all UN regions. The last of these consultations will be by the Group of Eastern European States on 3rd of August in Geneva. We are all aware of the severity of the plastic pollution crisis. In 2024 alone, humanity was projected to consume over 500 million tons of plastic in 2024 alone. Of this, 399 million tons will become waste. Plastic leakage into the environment is predicted to grow 50% by 2040. The cost of damages from plastic pollution could rise as high as a cumulative $281 trillion between 2016 and 2040. And health risks from plastic pollution are becoming clearer, especially due to microplastics. It is easy to do the math. We are facing an environmental crisis, and urgent action is needed now, with a treaty fit for purpose matching the scale of the problem. And this is not just an environmental crisis. It is a crisis for communities, economies, and future generations, and it spans across multiple sectors. As we look ahead to INC 5.2, this is a member-led process with the committee consisting of all UN members plus members of UN specialized agencies. Their delegations will convene on Tuesday, 5th August, alongside participants from accredited observer organizations for the opening plenary at 10 a.m. in the Assembly Hall, chaired by the chair of the committee. Meanwhile, the work will have already begun at the Palais before Tuesday the 5th. Regional consultations will take place on Monday the 4th, as will an in-person conversation with observers, where I will join the UN Environment Programme Executive Director, Ms. Inger Anderson, and the INC Ambassador, INC Chair Ambassador Luis Valles Valdivieso. This conversation with representatives from observer organizations will be recorded and available on the INC website soon after your viewing. In addition, the session's host country, Switzerland will hold a multi-stakeholder forum on Tuesday in the afternoon, on Monday in the afternoon, on the same venue on 4th of August. We are expecting our highest level of participation at this resumed session, with approved registrations from over 1,400 delegates, representing 179 members of the committee, and more than 1,900 participants from 600 observer organizations, including NGOs, IGOs, and UN entities. The expectation for this INC 5.2 is to conclude negotiations and approve the text of the instrument. If you have not done so already, I encourage you to review the chair's INC 5.2 scenario note on the website, which outlines the organization of work, procedural arrangements, and approach for the committee to optimize the precious 10 days available for finalizing and approving the text of the instrument. The negotiation work of the committee will take place in closed contact groups throughout the week alongside the regular plenary sessions, which is the committee's formal decision-making body. All plenary sessions will be live streamed on UN Web TV, and the session's live daily schedule will be available on the INC website and through an app. Most importantly, a key document that should be on your radar, if it isn't already, is the chair's text, as mentioned earlier. This text is a 22-page document with 32 draft articles that provides a structure for shaping the future instrument and will serve as a starting point for negotiations at this session. It builds on all the work that took place over the previous sessions of the INC, with the understanding that as the negotiations continue, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. I would like to end by saying, when the ink is dry and the gavel goes down, the work will only have just begun. Words need to be turned into action, and we will all need to turn our attention to the treaty's implementation. Thank you for your time, and please send any follow-up questions to the UNEP News Desk via the INC website. I turn back to you, Ms. Filucci. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Matufilip, for this briefing. It was important to give this information to the journalists today because, as people here know, Friday there is an official holiday in Switzerland. Palais will be closed. We won't have a briefing. And that's why I thank you very much for being with us today. And as you said, please ask any other question, either through the website indicated by Mrs. Matufilip or through Eunice. We are in constant contact with the communication lead of the secretariat. And of course, as you have also heard, there will be a lot of people at the Palais des Nations during these 2 weeks. Journalists, of course, are also welcome, but there will be a number of details on the logistics of your participation, so don't hesitate to ask us. So I'll open the floor to questions now. First in the room, Christian Ulrich is our correspondent of the German news agency.
Yes, hello. I reached out yesterday to the media email address, but I did not get an answer, so I wonder whether it's not live yet. And could you please share the notes? This is the Lisa Schlein question that I would like to deposit here. Can you please share the notes that you read from? Thank you.
Mrs. Matufilip, yeah, I see you nodding, and we will help you with sharing the notes to the journalists in Geneva if needed.
May I also come?
Yes, please go ahead.
We will have a media advisory also out this week, and of course all the notes will be shared. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, the notes, if it's possible, I'm saying this for your colleague, Jyoti, if the notes could go out as soon as possible so that the journalists have it today after your briefing. And then when the media advisory come, of course, that will also be much welcome. Is there any other question for UNEP? I don't see any, but I'm sure there will be many when the conference will start. But before we leave the issue of plastic, we also have an announcement from Catherine Wissou for UNCTAD on the publication of a plastic pollution report, right?
Thank you, Alessandra. My briefing will be in French. My notes will be shared in English. Je vais ajouter quelques chiffres sur l'économie et le développement autour des plastiques. Donc, avant l'ouverture des négociations qui viennent d'être présentées, la CNUSED va publier une mise à jour du commerce mondial, le Global Trade Update, spécifiquement sur le commerce des plastiques. Si les plastiques ont contribué à dynamiser l'économie mondiale, aujourd'hui, le risque est élevé qu'ils freinent la croissance de nombreux pays en développement. Quelques chiffres pour avoir une idée de l'ampleur. L'an dernier, le monde a échangé pour 1100 milliards de dollars de produits plastiques. C'est environ 5% du total des marchandises qui ont été échangées dans le monde. Et trois quarts de tout le plastique jamais produit sur la planète sont aujourd'hui des déchets, dont une grande partie s'échoue sur les côtes des petits États insulaires en développement et états côtiers, les plages qui font rêver les touristes ces pays qui manquent de moyens pour les gérer. Pourquoi c'est crucial de gérer cette question pour les pays en développement ? Ils entraînent bien sûr un coût environnemental. Je ne reviens pas sur les détails, un coût économique et puis bien sûr un coût social avec les dépenses de dépollution et de siphonnement des fonds publics qui sont déjà limités pour l'éducation, la santé ou la construction d'infrastructures. Mais il y a de bonnes nouvelles. Le plastique n'est plus fantastique, mais le document que nous allons publier montre que le marché mondial des substituts au plastique pèse aujourd'hui 485 milliards de dollars annuels et croît de 5,6% par an dans les économies en développement. Il y a donc là un véritable levier pour, avec de bonnes politiques commerciales, permettre à ces pays d'intégrer des nouvelles chaînes de valeur, de transformer des résidus agricoles, par exemple, en emballage compostable. Mais il y a beaucoup d'autres produits concernés par l'usage des ressources naturelles pour remplacer le plastique. Plusieurs options politiques sont décrites dans le document, comme réaligner les tarifs. Les tarifs appliqués au plastique sont inférieurs aux tarifs appliqués aux substituts du plastique, par exemple. L'investissement dans les infrastructures circulaires, il s'agit de collecter, recycler, réparer, et il faut trouver des fonds pour cela. Exploiter les outils numériques également, pour permettre de tracer les produits, aider les douanes et les petites entreprises à respecter les normes de durabilité à des coûts moindres et bien sûr créer des disciplines commerciales avec ce futur traité mondial sur les plastiques en cohérence avec les règles de l'OMC, la convention de Bâle et les accords climatiques. Le message de ce nouveau document qui sera publié demain, peut-être en fin de journée, mais en tout cas d'ici demain, le message est simple. Le commerce doit faire partie de la solution et non être la source du problème. Il va falloir donc réorienter les incitations et il est possible d'ouvrir de nouveaux marchés, de créer des emplois, de créer de la valeur, de protéger la planète et en particulier dans les pays qui ont le moins contribué à la pollution plastique mais qui en supportent le plus lourd fardeau. Voilà, c'est un document qui est assez court. Hein. Le Global Trade Update ne fait pas 100 pages. Donc, il vous sera communiqué dès que terminé, ce qui ne saurait tarder. Et bien sûr, nous sommes à votre disposition pour en détailler les recommandations. Merci.
Merci beaucoup, Catherine. Ça sera une bonne introduction à la négociation qui va commencer à Genève en début du mois d'août. Et pour ceux qui ne sont pas connectés et qui sont dans la salle, les media queries email address for the negotiating committee is unep-inkplastic.media@un.org. We will send it to you. There will be also the indication in the media advisory. And now, we thank you very much, Catherine. We come to our last, but definitely not least, speaker, who's Claire Nullis for WMO. And I'll ask Rolando to replace me on the podium as I have to rush to another meeting. Claire, welcome. You're also, of course, speaking about weather and climate extremes. It's not plastic, but it all relates to it. So I'll give you the floor and let Rolando take my place on the podium. Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks, Alessandra. Yes, it all relates to the environment and our wonderful planet. Yes, morning, everybody. Just to say, the World Meteorological Organization will announce a new world record for the longest lightning flash. We will do this on Thursday, the 31st of July. We've sent out the embargoed press release. It is available in all languages. So if you do need it in one of the other languages and you haven't received it, please just let me know. And in addition, if you need embargoed interviews, please contact me. I can set them up. And we only received it after we sent out the press release, but we've just received some really, really great visuals from one of the experts who was involved in establishing this new world record. It's got satellite imagery and other really good visual content. So again, please, if you need that, just send me a quick email and I will send it to you. The world record, which we will be announcing, it was established by a team of experts from the WMO Archive of Weather and Climate Extremes. This maintains official records of world hemispheric and regional extremes on things like temperature, pressure, rainfall, hail, wind, and lightning, as well as tropical cyclones. Of all the things that we do at WMO, I probably get the most questions on weather and climate extremes and on world records. So we do expect, you know, that this new announcement will see quite a lot of media interest on Thursday. As we know from, you know, from here, from looking out of our windows, lightning is a source of wonder, but it's also a major, major hazard which claims many lives around the world. So the new findings and one of the reasons that we do track, you know, lightning extremes is to highlight important public safety concerns about electrified clouds, which can produce flashes which travel incredible, incredible distances and have a big impact on public safety, the aviation sector, and as we unfortunately see too often, they can spark wildfires. That's all from me. As I said, we're not having a press conference because our main rapporteur, he's actually based at the University of Arizona, but as I said, I'm more than happy to set up interviews for you. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Claire. Hello, and thanks again very much for that very comprehensive brief. We do have a question for you from Antonio of EFE. Antonio.
Thank you, Rolando. I read the press release. It's an amazing record, but I wonder if the ray touched the land and if it did have an effect on the land, if it touched it. If not, I wonder, these extremely long rays are more powerful and can be more dangerous than the normal rays?
Yeah, I mean, this is all sort of embargo, so I don't want to say too much in case of breaking the embargo. I'll deal with it with you offline. I'd rather that, and I can set up a quick call, you know, with our expert. But just in general, I mean, when we issue, you know, new records for instance, heat extremes, this is quite often, you know, the case that there is actually a new record been set because it's, you know, it's got warmer. In the case of lightning, it's not necessarily because we are seeing longer lightning flashes than in the past. It's because, you know, satellite imagery is allowing them as to see them and to measure them much much better. But for your other questions, I can answer them offline.
Well noted. Thank you very much, Claire. I'm certainly interested in this report coming out Thursday, so thanks very much for the heads up. I think that does it for questions, unless there's a last look in the room, online, nothing here. So thanks once again, Claire, and good luck with that launch this coming Thursday. Colleagues, I have the easiest job because I have no announcements. I just came here momentarily to say hello, and I think the briefing's over. So see you here Tuesday, this coming Friday, once again, the 1st of August. It's a national holiday, so we won't have the briefing. I would like to thank all our briefers once again, and thanks to you for your attention, and see you here on Tuesday. And good luck with covering these upcoming conferences this week and next. Bye-bye.